This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how's everything going?
Well, Chris, it's going great here. No complaints. It's got some life changes coming up. Going to be moving soon, but other than that, life is pretty good.
Now, is that like moving from one side of the station to the other side of the station? Are you going to get a better location in relation to the promenade?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I will be moving closer to the Columbia River. So, I guess, unfortunately, there are no anti-grav lifts to help me with that move. Just good old-fashioned, you know, elbow grease and hard work, so...
Well, just remember the most important thing when you choose a location is, do they have good Jumja sticks nearby?
You know, actually, when we plotted where we were going to move on the map, you know, we were figuring out, where do we want to be? That was actually the first thing, was just typing in Google on maps, Jumja sticks locations. Jumja. Yeah. And so luckily we are going to be right down the street from a very reputable Jumja stick vendor, and I couldn't be more excited.
Excellent. And when you do that, you realize how geeky people are at Google, because it actually puts a little Jumja stick icon on the map in every location.
It does. Yes. Luckily they've tweaked that icon finally, because it kind of just looked like a big piece of poop earlier, a few years ago.
Well, but they were using just generic emoji.
Yeah, and it didn't work. Yeah. But I'm very excited. Goodness, I didn't know you could have a conversation for a good, 3 minutes about Jumja sticks, but...
You can, yeah. They are the unsung heroes of Deep Space Nine.
Maybe we should do a whole show on the Orb just about Jumja sticks.
We should. You know, we're always looking for unusual topics. I think that would be a really good one.
That would be our 10-minute topic.
Well, we've got the cameras running, as we always do, and so I wanted to ask you, Matthew, how do I look today?
As handsome as ever.
Exactly. I was wondering if you were going to quote the line from the episode or not.
Hey,
threw that out there like that.
Chris, I'm on top of things. I mean, I help host the Orb. I should right. Probably get that reference.
Although, Matthew, I will say that I feel a lot better when I hear that when it's coming from Kira as opposed to you.
I think we all do, Chris. I don't fault you for that at all.
All right. Well, that leads us right into what we're going to talk about today, which is something that's been requested by a lot of our listeners over the past few months and maybe even the past year, and that's the Circle Trilogy. I always felt like we've talked about this because we have talked about it here and there, and we did an entire show about it on the Ready Room, but we've never talked about the Circle Trilogy itself directly here on the Orb. And so we're going to do a mini series here, a 3-episode series, where we're going to go through each of the first 3 episodes of the Circle Trilogy. But Matthew, before we jump into the discussion, we also want to remind everyone who is new to the Orb, or maybe you just listen to the Orb and you don't listen to our other shows, that We're part of the Trekka Film Network. We have an entire family of 20 shows for you covering every topic in Star Trek. Matthew, tell everyone where they can find those shows.
Well, Chris, the best place to go would be, first, you can go to the website at trek.fm. You can check out all the shows, the descriptions of those shows, you know, what's talked about on each one of those shows. You can find the shows all over the place online. I mean, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. You can find us
on iTunes.
iTunes.
We have an artist section.
Exactly. Yeah. We are a feature provider, actually, in iTunes as well. So pretty much anywhere you can get audio content, you can find the shows on Trek and Femme. And in fact, we're slowly, Chris, making our way into
Spotify.
That's right, Spotify, which is...
We are.
Yeah, we're very excited to be there as well as they slowly start to add podcasts to that. So I encourage everyone, go check out all the shows. Each one has amazing merit for you to listen to. I mean, there's a good reason that we have these shows on the network. So if you like us, go check everybody else out too, because they're just as good, if not better, than we are.
That's right. That's right. And if you're an iTunes user, just go to itunes.com/trekafilm, and that'll shoot you right into our artist section, and you can find everything there. And if you want to share feedback on the show after you listen today, you can do that by finding us on Twitter. Our username is trekafilm. Facebook.com/trekafilm. We also have the Babel Conference, our listeners discussion group on Facebook, which we'll tell you about later on. Or you can send us an email by going to the website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb. All right, Matthew, well, let's jump on into the homecoming here, the first part of the Circle trilogy. And I watched this again to refresh my memory on the way home last night on the train. And
oh, so as you're doing a little homecoming yourself, Chris?
I was doing a little homecoming myself. I was, indeed. And although I like my job, so I didn't feel like I had been in a labor camp for 10 years like
well,
Lee Nahlis had been, which was good, yes. But nevertheless, it was still nice to come home. So this kicks off season 2 of Deep Space Nine. And as I was rewatching this last night, initially, that opening scene with Odo and Quark, I'm trying to put myself back in the mindset that I had the first time I ever saw this, where we did have the summer break, and we had come off of season 1, which felt more like the traditional Star Trek standalone format, became really interesting right there at the end with Duet and In the Hands of the Prophets. And then we get this, what I think is a very different feel right out of the gate. You could tell that they were going to do something really different with this series.
Chris, you know what I think is what happened, that throughout the first season, they kind of found their groove. You know, Deep Space Nine got its groove. And the last few episodes of the season, they kind of realized, okay, this is what this show is going to be. You know, and they had never tried to do anything like this. You know, they're so used to writing in the same mold for so long that I think this is a real challenge for the writers to kind of figure out, okay, how do we do this? And I think it's very clear from the beginning of this season that, okay, we are in a specific part of the universe. We're in the Federation. We're trying to bring this, you know, planet into the Federation. How does that work? What does that look like? You know, Kirk might meet them, Picard might meet them in a first contact, but we're the people who go in and actually make that happen. So what does this look like as we're trying to help a planet recover from, you know, a Holocaust? And I think all of that, they kind of figured out, okay, this is what this show is going to be. We're going to deal with the reality of life in the 24th century as we try to bring somebody into our family. And I think that just watching this today, right before we recorded, I was just struck about the quality of this episode. Like in the way that it feels like Deep Space Nine, you know, having watched the show so much. This is where, those last couple episodes of the first season, this is where Deep Space Nine finds its place in the Star Trek universe.
The fact also that they take 3 episodes to tell the story, it gives them that breathing room. So you get scenes like Kira meditating in her quarters, and you're starting to find out more what is life like on the station for each individual crew member. It's the kind of stuff where if you tried to cram this entire story, like if they did this story on TNG, it would have been done as a two-parter. Now, they could have done just the return of Nalis, and they could have had him named Nevark at the end and maybe not had him replace Kira, but just have him come back as this new leader or new inspirational figure for Bajor and ended the episode that way. And you could really have done it as just a single episode. Or they could do what they do in this three-part series here, just in two episodes. And I think that's how it would have been done. But by giving it three, they give it so much room to breathe. And for me, that's a lot of what gives it that DS9 feel right out of the gate for season two. That they're not trying to cram everything into 45 minutes.
Yeah, and I really like that because it's also making it, there's just a different feel. You know, life doesn't seem to move so fast when you're just zipping from planet to planet and ferrying, you know, advisors and, you know, people around all the time. And this is the slower pace. So you, like you said, you get all those great character moments, Jake and Sisko, you know, talking about him going on his first date and, you know, all those small little things that kind of help you feel as though you're a part of everyday life in Star Trek in a way that honestly, you've really never completely felt. I mean, there's a few times on TNG where you're in the workout room with Troy and Dr. Crusher when they're off, or you know you're in the poker room with the guys and the ladies as they're playing poker or something. But on a whole, most of the show takes place on the bridge or the transporter room, or
right.
You know, like
or a planet.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right. So this just kind of has that. No, this is what life is like for a majority of people who are, you know, in the 24th century, and, you know, not everybody's on a Star Trek just zipping around the galaxy.
They're not all astronauts on some sort of Star Trek.
Exactly.
Right, Matthew?
Exactly.
Hey, this is not on our outline, but since you mentioned it real quick, what did you think about Jake and his dad talking about his first date? And again, for me, because I have a son who is a teenager now, who's actually older than Jake is in this episode, he's 15. I am kind of starting to go through this as well. It's really interesting to see how Ben takes it, and especially thinking about the 24th century. No, you're not ready to be taking a girl to the holodeck. No, not back to our quarters.
Yeah, go into public. Just go hang
out. Get a table right in the center of Quarks. Right?
Exactly. I think this too is the beginning of that, where you can see how close that Avery and Sirach got, and just the way they play off each other, it really does feel like a real relationship between a father and a son. You know, I'm sure not all children are as kind of well behaved as Jake and polite to his father. You know, like this might turn into a whole argument with non 24th century people, but it's a very funny thing to see that. As much as things change, the more they stay the same. You know, dad's still not wanting their sons to get into trouble with girls too early, you know? So it's a really, I mean, I hate to say it, but it is a cute scene between them. It works so well.
You don't want them to yell, Dabo, too soon, right?
Exactly. That's putting it in Deep Space Nine terms.
That's right. But it's also nice that the writers, they give us the scene, which is just a great family moment between dad and son, but they also tie it into the story because it's important that this girl's dad will not let her go out with Jake because he's not a Bajoran, and it ties into the whole circle movement.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the things that is so interesting about the episode, and I was really piecing it together, you know, the Bajoran occupation is very much modeled after the Holocaust. And yet, after the Cardassians leave, they kind of flip and kind of turn into more of a Germany after World War I, where there's a power vacuum, there's all these things that have happened, And what begins to take over are these extremist groups. And, this is one of those places I think Deep Space Nine is just, it's so meta. It's ahead of its time in the way that it's telling these stories, because this is a story we're going to see play out over history.
Well, we're watching it play out right now, Matthew. That's exactly what's happening in Iraq and Syria with ISIS, is that there's a power vacuum and you have extremists taking over. I mean, it happens throughout history. Like you said, it happened with Germany. It's happening right now. It's going to happen in the future with somebody that we don't even know yet. It just happens. It's like a cycle. And so, yeah, this is a case where Deep Space Nine, the storytelling really connects with you in the present day, whatever that time might be for you. So it could be 50 years from now, and I think it will still connect with people because, like you say, it is very meta.
Well, and I think, too, that by kind of walking us through this, it's giving us a picture that, you know, things aren't just easy in the 21st century. You know, things are still difficult. And as the Federation entangles itself with these people that it's trying to bring into the fold, things get messy, you know? It's not so cut and dry. And I think that's one of the things that's so nice about Deep Space Nine and them being able to introduce the fractured nature and the conflict without really having to go too much against Gene's ideas, you know? And I think it just creates a deeper, richer story that you really get to dive into. And heck, this is the first episode of the second season, so that's fantastic.
Yeah. It's interesting also to see what's happening with Bajor here, because we often talk about, maybe not so much on this show, but certainly on literary treks, we talk about how the expanded universe in the literature can really enhance your viewing experience of Star Trek on television and Star Trek that you already know. And I believe it's the short story Horn and Ivory, right, where we find out that the reason that Bajor is called Bajor is because originally there were all of these different religious sects on Bajor and these nation states, and the Bajora are the ones who ultimately united everyone. And so the planet is now Bajor, and that's where the whole religion, when we look at Bajor on Deep Space Nine, we really see one religion, right? Like the entire planet, everyone is united in this one belief, but it wasn't always like that. That's a background that we don't have when we're watching this. If you're only watching the series or you're watching this the first time, you don't have that background. And I'm sure the writers didn't have that background either. This is something that was filled in much later. But when you think about it now, you see what an impact something like the Cardassian occupation can have on this society, that it fractured thousands and thousands of years of unity. And now you have all these groups fighting against each other again. And it gives rise to a movement like the Circle, which is very xenophobic. And the shock of having been occupied for half a century by an alien race has led them to want to expel all aliens, no matter what, even if the presence of those aliens would be beneficial to them.
Yeah, it creates, and Kira even talks a little bit about how bad things have gotten on Bajor and these different sects fighting against each other, and it does kind of have that feeling of almost a Middle East on, you know, Bajor, especially if you're watching it now, maybe even for the first time, you hear those words and it immediately connects you to something that is happening right now.
Or like the African continent as well. Places where things have been carved up by someone else, right? And then groups that maybe originally did not have as much conflict, or they had found a way to manage themselves, were thrown back into conflict because of some event that happened.
Right. And like you said, you know, this planet had found unity. Mm-hmm. And after 50 years of everything being thrown into utter chaos, trying to find a way back to that and build a government and everything like that, it's very difficult, especially when, you know, the people that are trying to do that are the ones who grew up knowing only war.
Yeah.
And So it's and a lot of those people, I think, that might be able to help may have died, you know, during the occupation. So all these ramifications going together, it makes for just a very complex, very deep and rich storytelling experience as you're just diving into the, you know, the second season.
Were you surprised to see the introduction of a violent extremist group into the show just starting off the second season? You know, we had seen, I think back to TNG and The High Ground, where they visit this planet and there is a terrorist group fighting against the government. Beverly gets kidnapped. But that's one episode, right? Here we're really establishing not only an extremist group, but we're really setting up what will play out over the course of this three-episode arc, a political coup on a planet that is trying to gain admission into the Federation. So they really set up something that I feel like we haven't seen before in Star Trek, something for the Federation to have to deal with.
I think it's something that is so realistic. You know, they really introduced this element of realism into Deep Space Nine. And, you know, thinking about, I think, as the writers probably did, okay, what would it be like to be on this planet, 50 years of occupation? Everything's kind of been decimated. Everything we knew has been, the only thing that's got us through is our faith in ourselves. It seems natural in some ways for a group like the Circle to come about, where it's Bajor first, you know, we have to put ourselves first because that's the only way that we got to where we were. And, you know, Kira herself was very much in that frame of mind at the beginning of the first season. And now she's come full circle because she's spent this time working with the Federation and seeing that they're here to do good. But the rest of the people on Bajor, they don't have that opportunity to really experience life with these people that are trying to help them. All they know is that the provisional government has been inept at trying to get anything done, and nothing's getting done, and nobody's getting helped. And
hey, it sounds like our own governments these days around the world.
Exactly. It feels like just like the bureaucracy that we see even in formed governments, they've been around for a long time. So it is, again, I think it's one of those things where to have this kind of violent extremist group come out of that, we've been seeing that since almost, I feel like, the dawn of history and people being upset, you know? So
yeah, so I agree. It is very realistic. It seems like it's the kind of thing that in previous Star Trek, we would see planets where this was happening, but we're just visiting that planet. We're just passing by. We're just there for some reason, and then we're gone. Whereas here, they're making it really a drawn-out part of the story that our heroes, as the Federation, really get tangled up in. It's also interesting when you connect that with, again, it's writing that came later down the road, but on the timeline, it comes first. You see a similar thing happening on Earth with humans after the Zindi attack on Enterprise, where they also are into, well, you have the Terra Prime movement, you have Earth First. And that shows that while here we're seeing it with an alien culture, we see that we're also susceptible to that ourselves. The other thing that's interesting about it here in Deep Space Nine with the Bajorans is the fact that they're such an ancient culture. You know, we see ourselves in the 24th century on Star Trek as being so enlightened as humans and so advanced, but they were doing what we were doing thousands of years earlier, and yet they can still fall into the same trap.
Well, I think that that kind of base nature of people, it goes to show what, 50 years of death and occupation and torture and rape and murder and all that can do to a people, and it makes you desperate, and it makes you do things that you never thought you'd do to try and survive. And so I think that that's a really, again, it's one of those layers here that they're kind of driving at, that this is kind of, you know, Quark says it once, you know, if you take away all of their comforts and all of their replicators and their holosuites, you know, what's underneath humans is still that base being, and and that being will do whatever it takes to survive, and that can be really bad. So I think this is just an interesting way of them showing that's not just a human thing. That's like seems to be a universal thing.
Yeah,
for
it's like
any
part
race.
Of life.
Yeah, it's a part of life. So
going back to Kira, also which you mentioned, how she deals with Sisko in this episode, coming off the break, coming back into the new season, showed some growth there as well, because in the first season, they're really butting heads and all. And here, I mean, you can tell they're not in perfect agreement, but she seems to have a growing respect for him, maybe a growing understanding of why he's there, and a better idea of how to work with him as well. And I think Sisko also seems to be loosening up a little bit, especially towards Kira, as, yes, he's the Starfleet commander there, but he seems at the start of the second season to understand that he's kind of far away from everything else that's going on in the Federation, and he's going to run the station his way.
Yeah, I thought that this was, again, this is just a great way to start the season and show how season one is impacting the season two characters. There's a dramatic difference in the relationship that Kira and Sisko are experiencing. And I love that scene when they're sitting there and she's like, "You don't want to know." And he's like,
"Yeah,
well,
you don't
want to
ask
me
that."
Yeah, I have to know. And then he puts down his fork and I feel like he wants to throw them down and like, "Damn it, I didn't want to know that." Yeah. But I had to know that, you know. So I think that it is, you know, the fact that he doesn't just automatically tell her no, and even then he doesn't even just say no, it's a clear progression in their relationship. Mm-hmm. And I really like seeing that, because that relationship is just going to continue to get stronger as we move forward, and by the end of the show, you know, there's nobody who is more on Sisko's side than Kira, I think. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. And I wanted to ask you a question. Did you see the kind of hint that Kira and O'Brien would become better friends just in the scenes that they had together? Because I caught up on, to me, a little bit of just friendship chemistry between those two, just in the scenes that they had and the way they worked together in this episode.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, the fact that O'Brien had already worked out all the plans for modifications to the runabout before Sisko even approved it. If he didn't feel like helping Kira, he would not have even thought about that. And also, I was paying attention again to see if he said it for sure, and I don't think he does, but I got the feeling that he had already made all of those modifications to the runabout ahead of time. Not just thinking about it, but actually made them. Did you get that impression?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, that he had kind of figured all that out and like even maybe had to create some himself
like
that.
The ship was ready to go because everyone else on the station,
he'd
knew
already
about
been secretly working
and,
on
yeah,
it.
They're working
yeah.
on it. But yeah, I mean, like even when they're leaving and Kira tells him that this mission can only end in one of two ways, either we bring Lee Nalis back or we don't come back. And O'Brien's like, "Understood." You know, there's no argument there. There's no Starfleet versus Bajor sort of dispute. And I would kind of expect Miles to say something like, "But, you know, Keiko needs me." But apparently he's not worried at all about Keiko. He's like, "Okay, yeah, it's cool. If I don't come back, it's fine."
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't even think about them. You know, I think that's one of those things where the character of O'Brien is, there is a part of him that is kind of a soldier. You know, and
well, he is. That's his background. That
and,
is established.
And what he's, what he's done to, or what he's experienced with the Cardassians, I think puts him on the side of, "No, I want to go rescue these people." I think that was a
That's really true. Nice
moment. And it made a lot of sense when you're kind of thinking about his background and especially what we'll continue to find out, you know, throughout the series. It's a small moment that's creating character growth opportunities for the character here, mm-hmm. but also throughout the rest of the series.
Exactly. And once they get to Cardassia 4 and they go down to the planet, yeah, the chemistry between Miles and Kira is really good. And it's really funny to see O'Brien pimping Kira. You know, I mean, it's all a big act, of course, but the way that he plays it and the way she plays it up as well was really well done. And yeah, I can see the what you're talking about, where their friendship is growing there.
Well, and even the accent that he puts on, like he's like the East, you know, the East Coast, you know, like
he's from the East Side of the station, man.
Yeah, yeah, you know, take a look at the merchandise we got it, right? You know. It was very funny the way that they were playing that, and it felt like that they had been a team for so long.
Right. Yeah.
That's what I loved about it, that instant kind of chemistry that they had together, and it makes it really even more interesting, I think, now that I think back to, you know, when she's having their baby and everything and how that all goes. So yeah, I really liked that part of the episode that Kira is getting the opportunity to grow closer to Sisko and creating even more friends on the station. You know, you can tell Dax is her friend. You can tell that O'Brien is her friend. And I think, gosh, you just think about the character growth that's already happening from season one to season two here for just Kira herself. It's tremendous.
I'm picturing in the runabout, especially at this point in the series, the runabout's fairly large. So there have to be areas that we haven't actually seen on screen. And I'm picturing an area where there's this big mirror, like this walls, this giant mirror, and all the way over to Cardassia 4, they're standing in front of that mirror practicing that scene of how they're going to sell Kira to the Cardassian in order to get into the camp.
And she keeps being like, O'Brien, loosen up.
Yeah.
Play it sleazier.
And then she'll say, oh, he wouldn't know what to do with me. And then O'Brien will burst out laughing. And then she'll burst out laughing. And they'll say, okay, let's start. Take it from the top. Let's take it from the top.
Take it serious, guys. Let's go. Pull it together, O'Brien.
That's why they were so relaxed by the time they got there. You know, they had been practicing that for quite a while.
Yeah.
Here's one other thing before I forget to mention it. Did you notice when Sisko and Kira have their little sit down, Sisko comes in and orders his Ractigino with the jacarine peel, but then he orders an Iconberry tart from a different replicator on the other side of the room. Did you see him take the Ractigino and then walk over to the other replicator and order the tart?
I noticed that. So is there like a drink replicator?
Apparently.
And then like a food replicator?
Cause apparently.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. And I rewound the episode. You can tell I used to watch things on videotape, right? I rewound the episode. I skipped back and I replayed the scene again. I'm like, did he really just take the drink from one replicator and go to another one to order food? But yeah, he does. Do we ever see that happen again?
I don't think so. That had to be just a directorial thing.
Yeah, like we need him to walk over and do something.
Yeah.
It's really weird. I had never even considered the fact that there could be beverage replicators.
That's the drink replicator. Go get your food elsewhere.
You're standing there. You're like, Pina Arrabbiata. And you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting. You're like, why wouldn't it give me my bloody food? And someone walks up and goes, dude, that's the drink replicator?
Yeah. He's like, oh, that's why it kept giving me pina coladas.
Right. Oh, man. Okay, well, let's talk about Lee Nahlis a bit. Obviously, he's very important in the episode. As a 10,000 Maniacs fan, I love the fact that he actually quotes a song here when he says, I'm not the man. But what do you think about Lee Nahlis? The portrayal of the character, generally over the years, I have not particularly liked this performance because I feel like the performance is very flat. It's like he really doesn't want to be there. At the same time, I try to think about the fact that, okay, this guy's been in a labor camp for 10 years. And as we learn in The Homecoming, he's also carrying this weight that, well, I don't know if he's, maybe he is. We don't get enough of the conversation in the camp between him and his fellow Bajorans to know how they view him. It could be that he's been there for 10 years and his fellow Bajorans in the camp are just constantly praising him and talking about what a hero he is when he reveals to Sisko that that story is really not true. And maybe he's just tired of hearing about it. And now he gets back to Bajor and Kira wants to put him up on a pedestal as the savior. And now he's got thousands and thousands of people or an entire planet seeing him as this hero as well, and he's exhausted. And if that's the case, maybe the portrayal that we see makes a bit more sense. But how do you feel about the portrayal of Nalis?
You asked the question, and at least here, I'd say just this episode, that it works. You know, if we're just judging this episode, I think it really does work, of a character who has kind of gotten tired of living mm-hmm. this lie, and he thought that he was done for. And I get the feeling like he has been living with this in this camp because, you know, they've sent off his earring to try and get him rescued.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, he's still been living with it for all of these years. And I think maybe he thought, okay, I'm done. I can let it go. And then Sisko tells him, well, your people still need you. You know, it reminded me so much of in The Dark Knight where Gordon's like, he's not the hero we deserve, but he's the hero we need. And like, that's kind of where Lee Nalis is. He's a lie mm-hmm. as a hero, but he's also kind of what the legend that they kind of need to be there.
And he's not a lie in the sense that he completely fabricated some identity for himself.
Right, right.
And sold that to people. But they did it, and then he sort of allowed it to happen. And then maybe he regrets the decision to allow it to happen. And now he's tired of hearing it all the time because he knows it's not true. So it's a little bit different than someone who just completely creates a lie to elevate themselves. It was never his intention to elevate himself. I'm sure that at the time in the fighting, he probably thought, okay, well, yeah, I'll let them believe this because it's really helping their morale. It's going to help us win this fight against the Cardassians. But then once that was over, that benefit of allowing it to continue wasn't there anymore. And then it became a weight upon him.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think of him as the forlorn living legend, you know, mm-hmm. like he didn't ask to be the legend. He got, you know, thrust onto the pedestal of one because somebody misrepresented him killing a helpless Cardassian in their underwear, you know.
Mm-hmm. Although a very famous helpless Cardassian who had massacred many people. Yeah.
And so I think that I do. I personally hear, at least in this episode, we're just talking about this one, mm-hmm. I think the performance plays out exactly what they're wanting to have him do, which is to feel like somebody who is defeated by everything, like mm-hmm. his life as it's been, the lie he's had to live, everything, and he's just ready to kick back on the veranda and you know, Bajor with a glass of spring wine and live out the rest of his life, you know, maybe selling Jumja sticks. You know, like, this guy is just done with it all. And everybody keeps asking more and more of him. And, you know, that's a hard thing in life to be, especially when what they're asking for, you know, you're, at least you believe you're really not.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm picturing a shop on the promenade called Lee Jumja.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, this is something that I've been slowly coming around to. I imagine, I have no recollection what I said about him on The Ready Room because we did that episode years and years ago, but I'm pretty sure at that time I probably talked some about how I felt the performance was weak and flat. But
yeah,
the last few times I've watched this episode, I'm starting to come around to feeling that, as you said, in this particular episode in The Homecoming, yeah, it probably plays out the way that it should, because he needs to be reluctant, right? The story doesn't work if he's not reluctant to be seen as a hero coming back to Bajor. And even being given this position of Navark and being made the liaison officer to the station is something that he clearly doesn't want.
Yeah, I love that he's like, There wasn't a title.
I know, right?
So they made some crap up.
But what gets me about that scene first is Kira's like, congratulations. And you know that she's never heard of a Navart before because there's never been one. But yet, if the chancellor comes in and has this, if the first prime minister, whatever his title is, comes in and tells Kira this new title, she immediately falls in a line like, oh, that's awesome. You're a Navark. And he's like, yeah, there's never been one before. It's some completely made up thing they came up with. And I don't want it, but what am I going to do?
Well, I think you can see, like, this guy is just so tired of having to live his life resigned to doing things he doesn't want to do.
Yeah. Well, talking about him being a legend, another question here is, what's more important, truth or legend? Right? Is it more important for the cause? What Kira is concerned about is uniting the planet. And that's what Kaiopaka was trying to do as well, right? Hold everyone together. And even when Sisko talks to Nalis in here, he talks about the benefit that Nalis could bring to the Bajoran people. Like, it doesn't matter if the story is true or not. It's just what it means to different people. And when you look at situations like this, how do you feel about truth versus legend and its importance?
Oh, this is a tough question. And I think it's best played out in the Dark Knight trilogy, honestly. They build a lie, and then the lie gets found out, and it almost completely destroys everything. And I think there's a reason that the saying is the truth will set you free. And I don't think that, you know, this one's a little bit different in the sense that it's an exaggeration for him. It's not really a lie. He did kill the Cardassian. Mm-hmm. It's a complete exaggeration, though.
It's an exaggeration by others, right?
Not by others. Exactly. I don't know, because, you know, in the end, a lot of times legends have a way of inspiring others, and obviously that's what's happening here. Because he's not directly responsible for inflating his story himself, I think the idea that they're trying to get to is that obviously the Bajorans can be something different, something better. And yeah, as we move forward, you know, it's interesting to watch him actually end up living up to his reputation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it makes for an interesting question. The way that they have this one phrased of, you know, I don't know if it's so much of a lie. It's just a story.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a difference, I think.
Well, it's like a tall tale, you know. I was just thinking that we never would have dug the Grand Canyon without the legend of Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
Now people are going to send us mail. We didn't dig the Grand Canyon, but you know what I'm saying? Like, the legends, I think history is replete with exaggerations, and legends are what drive us forward often, because the truth is generally less interesting. The actual truth is generally less interesting than what we think of as the truth as the years go by, especially after decades or centuries go by. And that original truth gets embellished in a way that inspires people, and it becomes part of our identity, and it helps drive us. And so I think that while it would be difficult on the individual who is the subject of the legend, I think the legend itself is really important. I think generally when we have legends like this, they build to a point where they are at this state after that person's gone, right? So that person doesn't have to deal with the legend anymore. That's why we have the phrase living legend, right? Some people are living legends, but majority of legendary people lived long ago. But just seeing the introduction of this legend also enhances the Bajoran story to me as well, because, you know, they are an ancient civilization, and they've been through a lot of turmoil.
Yeah, I think that this was a really smart way to open the season, just because of the simple fact that we are diving into Bajor, its history, what's happened to them, and that's the area of space that we're in. That's the mission. You know, Ben and Gen Zia talk about this is the mission, and it's a really tough mission. It's tougher than most entrance into the Federation stories, I believe, what they're trying to accomplish here. So I just think it was so wise of them to begin to dive into that mythology of Deep Space Nine full force this part of the series, and this is really where they make the decision of, okay, this is the type of story that we're going to continue to tell on this show. And to me, it's I'm really excited by it. Even watching it today, I respond to this episode still, and I think part of that is just because so much of this episode I unfortunately can kind of still see playing out in our world now, and the relevance of it is, it's like, okay, I'm rewarded for watching this because it's reminding me that Star Trek could teach me something, maybe, how are they going to get past this, and that's when Star Trek in the end is at its best. So
yeah, here on Deep Space Nine, in order to get into the Federation, we have to help rebuild a planet from a holocaust. And in Insurrection, Picard just has to wear a funny wig on his head for a few minutes. And exactly. Those guys can get into the Federation.
Yeah.
So yeah, exactly. This is much more difficult than the typical Federation entry process, apparently. All right. Well, God, there's so much to talk about in this one episode. I mean, we didn't talk about Quark and Odo. We didn't talk about, we didn't talk about Rom as well. It was interesting to see Rom kind of starting to come more into his own here. And are there any last points you want to make about the episode? Because we're already kind of barreling towards an hour here.
Yeah, I just, if you haven't seen this one in a while, I'd say go check it out again. It's the place where Deep Space Nine, I think, finds its legs and starts telling those stories that we think of as quintessential Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine isn't just the Dominion War show. It's the show about the 24th century, and specifically, too, the progress of this planet and this people, along with this captain and, or at least at this point, this commander.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. I really like this episode, and watching it today, I was like, oh, I don't have enough time to keep going.
I know, right? You want to watch all three at once, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I posted in the Babel conference that I was watching this on my iPhone on the way home yesterday, and posted a picture of the platform, the train station, and Jeff Iaconis, one of our listeners, immediately asked, well, did you watch The Siege? Did you watch The Circle? I'm thinking, no, I only had time for this one, unfortunately.
Right.
But you do want to watch the whole story, right? Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, we will continue this series soon, and we'll do one episode, one show for each episode of the arc. So, Matthew, if people want to find you and everything else that you've got going on, when you're not busy practicing your own invasion tactics for when you need to visit a Cardassian stronghold, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on Instagram, posting things, all the things we post, from things about Trek FM and more, at MRushing. You can also find me doing literary treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We are barreling through to the end of the Deep Space Nine relaunch. We're very excited about that. In fact, we just had David R. George III on, talking about his latest Deep Space Nine book. So if you're a Niner, or you just like more in the 24th century, you got to check out Literary Treks. And then you can also find me on the 602 Club. We'll pick a new geeky topic each week, whether it's a new movie that's come out, old classics, really just a way to help people find things that they might not have tried before, so you can listen to the show and think, oh, that might be interesting, or it could be the thing that you love, or it could be the thing you hate. any one of those is a great reason to listen, because, you know, you might find a different perspective. And as Obi-Wan said, it's all from a certain point of view. So that's the fun thing about the show. And then I have my own personal blog at 42alifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not swindling Rom out of his hard-earned cash, where can we find you?
Yeah, except I'm worse than Quark. I say, it's one for you, eight for me.
Oh, man, such a jerk.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook, and you can find me in the Babel Conference as well on Facebook. And you can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, which is a show where we talk about news and we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series. We have lots of great guests. The new episode will drop right around the time of this orb, and Larry Nemechek is co-hosting with me once again. And we're talking about Enterprise and Tellarites, actually, because Larry has the first draft original script of Bounty when the Tellarites were not Tellarites. And it's kind of interesting to hear about. And then elsewhere in the world of Star Trek, you can find me on StarTrek.com, the official site where I write a column called Trekspectives. And the one I'm working on right now actually has a little bit of a Circle Trilogy twist to it, although it's not about the Circle Trilogy, but you'll find out when that gets published and you can read it. And you can also find me talking about things other than Star Trek, believe it or not, on my podcast called Metropolis On Air. That is the podcast that is tied to my magazine here in Tokyo. And I talk to lots of interesting people about the things that they do and the things they create and life in Japan, life in Tokyo, charities that we're working on, all kinds of things like that. And we have a lot of fun on that show as well. We have lots of different segments, a lot of variety. And you can find that in iTunes. And again, it's called Metropolis On Air. And then you can find me on my personal website, cbrianjones.com. Matthew, a couple of other quick things here as we close out. We, of course, want to thank our associate producers here on The Orb. We have Ruth Ward, who you can find on Twitter at reward64, and you can also find her in the Babel Conference. Also, we have Will Wynn, who is also on Twitter at will_Wynn, and you spell Wynn, N-G-U-Y-E-N. And then also Ken Tripp. And Ken is not on Twitter. I actually asked him just before we recorded the show here to make sure he doesn't have a Twitter handle, and he doesn't. But you can find him in the Babel Conference. Also find Will in the Babel Conference. Matthew, what is the Babel Conference? I keep saying this, and I'm not explaining it.
Well, the Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group, Chris. So if you listen to the shows, you're the only people who find out about the Babel Conference, and we have great discussions there about so many things. I mean, we have amazing Star Trek discussions, and then, of course, anything that we talk about on the 602 Club gets talked about there, and it's just a great way for fans to interact in a very positive way, in a very uplifting way. We have great conversations that involve constructive critique as well, and all in a way that makes you feel good about being there, and that's very rare on the internet these days, so I hope that you'll decide to join the Babel Conference.
Yeah, it's a great, great forum. So hope you'll come and join us over there. And then also, we are a listener-supported network. You know, we don't have commercials in the shows, but it does cost us a lot of money to produce these shows. And if you like what you're hearing and you want to help us out and become part of the team, you can do that on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out all the information. And we have some great perks for you there. Every little bit helps us, and we do hope that you'll join the crew and help keep Trek FM healthy and strong.
Thank you, everyone, so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.